Yeah, it is. You pushed it up.
Good morning, and welcome to the Jewish Ethics Lecture Series on Betting and Speculation. I would like to begin by thanking Rabbi Rosenbaum and Yom Gezel Shomrei Emunah for once again graciously hosting us for the Sunday morning lecture series and the many programs, the classes that we do here. It's very much appreciated. And we have a wonderful opportunity this morning to hear from a director of studies, Rabbi Yitzhak Grossman, on betting and speculation. Some people asked me, in light of today's theme, if I would make a prediction on the game today, and I said no, but you could ask me privately afterwards. And Rabbi Grossman is an eminent scholar. If you've been following him, he has an expertise on a tremendous range of different topics and the intersection of Torah and secular knowledge. As well, there's besides a lot of ongoing call programming that you could take advantage. There are many flyers over there on the table. There's two upcoming lunch and learns that Rabbi Grossman is giving. One is this coming Thursday in Rockville, on December 15th at the Beekel Building. That is on Laissez Faire and the economic interventionism, as well as a week from Monday in D.C. at Morgan Lewis in the law firm, and that will be on fair pay. So with that, my pleasure to introduce to you Rabbi Yitzhak Grossman.
Reiterate Rabbi Winter's thanks to the shul, to Rabbi Rosenbaum, for everyone for coming, and I thank Rabbi Winter and the whole kollel for arranging this. Gambling, wagering on games of chance, dice, cards, sporting events, races, in modern culture it falls into a category we refer to as vice. Vice includes things like smoking and drinking. Vice is a general category of things that culture or society frowns or used to frown on, still frowns on as being somehow wrong and problematic. Not all of it is illegal. If certain types of vice, if police stations have vice squads, if certain types of vice are illegal, vice is a much broader category, things that society does not approve of, considers immoral, destructive, antisocial, but not necessarily illegal. Gambling, as we're going to discuss today, falls into a similar category in halacha. There is a pretty long-standing tradition of disapproval, strong disapproval from numerous sources, going back to the Talmud, going down to the later code, contemporary rabbinic thinkers, as we'll see. Yet, it is far from clear that it is generally prohibited, why it should be prohibited, when it is prohibited. And as we'll see, it's actually an interesting area of halacha where much of the interesting literature, which we're not actually going to quote, but much of the interesting literature is outside the normal stream of halachic literature. It appears in communal rules, sometimes even passed by the lay leadership of Jewish communities to ban different types of practices, because socially it was often perceived as a social pact, so to speak, although it isn't always clear what the halacha would actually have to say about different types of gambling. Particularly, we're coming up toward Hanukkah. Hanukkah is a time where gambling, for several hundred years in Europe, in Ashkenazi communities at least, gambling was a thing that people did on Hanukkah. Many poskim were strongly against it, the Mishnah Berurah, the Aruch HaShulchan. Other poskim were lamid chutz. They found rationalization for why people did it. As we'll see, it is remarkably, maybe not so remarkably, for those experienced with halacha, difficult to come to a clear, black and white answer on whether it is prohibited or permitted. We're going to discuss today some of the different issues, some of the potential problems involved, as well as exactly how gambling differs from the casino of Wall Street, financial speculation, betting on financial products. Discuss exactly how rabbinic thought conceived of the problem of gambling and how it's different from other types of betting and wagering that you can do in life. Now, broadly speaking, we can group the concerns that Torah thought has against gambling, the concerns with gambling, into roughly three categories: problems with winning, problems with losing, and problems with the pastime of gambling itself. Winning, as we'll discuss soon, was often seen as a problem of theft. If you win at cards with your friend, with your neighbor, and he pays you out money that he can barely afford to pay, that he doesn't have, his kid's shoes, his kid's school tuition, then there is a concern of theft that you are, we'll discuss in more detail why that should be called theft, but there is a concern that by taking money from the loser at cards, loser at a game of chance, you are committing some sort of theft against him. So that's a problem with winning. There are problems with losing. Those are the problems we discussed earlier, social problems that communities realize when people lost their shirts at cards. It was bad for the communal stability, for family stability, bad for shalom bayis. It destroyed marriages, destroyed communities, destroyed otherwise stable societies. That's a problem with losing. And the third problem concerns gambling was seen as a frivolous at best, you know, worthless and frivolous at best, or dissolute, degenerate, and immoral pastime at worst. We call, you know, Las Vegas is called Sin City for a reason. It's, they've tried to Disneyfy it over the years, the pendulum swings back and forth, but at the end of the day, we know that gambling is often associated with a whole host of other immoral issues, and traditionally, I think it always was to some extent. It was always a gateway, or it was always associated with other types of bad behavior. So that basically we have problems with winning, problems with losing, and problems with the pastime itself. And the truth is, when we discuss the problems with the pastime itself, it being considered pointless and frivolous and unproductive, this is an interesting kind of a very slippery slope, a very gray area. You can argue that even when there's no money involved, playing backgammon or chess or checkers or anything else for Call of Duty and modern computer games, whatever it is, you can argue anything is pointless and passive. We can argue that, you know, all the studies that show that there are benefits to some of these things, but at the end of the day, who defines what's productive? Human beings need some kind of outlet, some kind of entertainment, and as we'll see, some posts can indeed justify various types of these activities, putting aside the question of the money, but the mere thing that you're engaged in pointless and unproductive enterprise, that we're going to see some post-kim did actually argue that it's healthy and normal and tolerable for people to engage in activities, what we call leisure activities, entertainment and leisure activities that have no well-defined, objective, productive purpose, but that's part of being human. We play, we do other things, so that's also a debate. But anyway, these are roughly speaking the three general concerns post-kim have had with gambling and related activities. So now we'll begin to go through some of the traditional attitudes to explore, you know, why or why not, you know, are these things really problems or not. So the Talmud already discusses really two out of these three concerns. The Talmud discusses both the problems of winning constituting theft, as well as the problem of just engaging in pointless and unproductive activity. The Talmudic discussion of gambling occurs in an odd place. The Talmud does not go ahead and establish front and center, thou shalt not gamble. The Talmud is discussing the laws of witnesses, that in halakha, unlike in secular courts, the way it works is, in secular courts, anyone just testifies, and then it's the job of the jury to decide, you know, sort it out, who's believable, who's credible, who's not. Halakha works with a very different system. There are people who are a priori accepted as valid witnesses, and their testimony has halakhic validity. There are people who are a priori excluded as being invalid witnesses. We don't accept their testimony to begin with. Credibility decisions don't come until afterwards. The one category of people who may not testify are people who are rishayim, people who engage in forbidden, evil, antisocial, different types of problematic conduct. So the Mishnah in Sanhedrin lists examples of various types of activities which would be considered prohibited by halakha, problematic activities, on either a biblical level or a rabbinic level. So one of the categories is misachek bekuvya. Right afterwards is malva beribis. So misachek bekuvya means someone who plays with dice, plays at some kind of games of chance. Malva beribis is usurers, people who lend money at interest, which of course is a serious prohibition in Judaism. Afri chayonim is a somewhat obscure phrase. It either means bird racers, pigeon racers. Today we race horses mostly, sometimes dogs. Back then they used to raise birds, apparently. Other pshatim in the Gemara. But anyway, misachek bekuvya certainly is one of the categories. Someone who gambles is considered sinful, is considered apparently a rasha, and he is automatically excluded as a witness. Now, the Talmud wonders why. What is it about gambling that is so pernicious that it excludes somebody, renders him invalid as a witness? The Talmud brings two suggestions. Two different authorities offer two different suggestions. One of them is that it's a form of theft, called afmachta. The other one is that a person is eina osek bi shuvah shel olam. He's engaged in activity which does not benefit the Yishuv HaOlam is a settlement of the world, meaning productive and useful enterprise. Someone who gambles and not Otik Bishuva Shel Olam is not engaged in productive activity. The second one is pretty easy to understand. It means someone who's, you can build a house, you can mow a lawn, you can program a computer, you can cut diamonds, you can do lots of useful things. Gambling benefits no one. Now, the Talmud is clear, this would mean a professional gambler. This does not refer to someone who is gambling in his leisure time. This refers to someone who has no other activity. Someone who has nothing to do except gamble. He's devoted his life to not being a productive member of society. That is a problem. That's one opinion. The other opinion is that gambling is a form of theft. To understand better what the Talmud means, the Talmud refers to it as asmachta. Asmachta is a term of art, a juridical term from the Talmud. Basically, asmachta refers to certain types of contractual clauses, not limited to gambling. It's a very broad principle that is fundamental and central to understanding the contract law, Talmudic contract law. Asmachta means that it's very difficult to pin down in one sentence, but basically it means certain types of contracts which involve penalties or contingencies, which are unlikely to happen, which people hope won't happen, which people are not planning on, which are just put there to satisfy the other party, but the party who's committing himself doesn't really want it to happen, doesn't expect it to happen, and doesn't really want it to happen, is not fully committed to that clause. Such a clause is void as asmachta. Again, the classic example is the penalty clause, but the Talmud, according to one opinion, applies this to asmachta. The rules are quite complicated. It applies this to gambling, from Zaka Bakuvia. The rules are quite complicated. Penalty clauses themselves, there are many ways to structure them in ways that are valid. The most basic case is that if a penalty is liquidated damages, it's payment for actual damage at least. Liquidated damage is more problematic, but if it's set up to be compensation for actual harm caused by the other party, that's fair. That's not an arbitrary penalty, but an arbitrary penalty that's unconnected to any actual harm could be called asmachta. And gambling, the Talmud brings one opinion, constitutes an asmachta. Gambling is essentially a contract. The two players or the player in the house enter into a contract that, depending on the outcome of some event, some contest, something, one party or the other will win, will pay, will receive, will collect, will not collect, and so on. That's essentially a contract that both parties enter into. The parties expect to win. The gamblers certainly expect to win. And therefore, such a contract is invalid, and if you take money under this contract, the Gemara calls it asmachta, and that is a form of theft. Now, the question is, and this is a question that has no easy answer, is what is the normative halacha here? What is the actual view of the halacha? The other opinion said it's not theft. It's just a problem of engaging in unproductive enterprise. Whether it's theft or not is a complex and very difficult discussion in the Rishonim, the early authorities, the later authorities. The bottom line is that it is completely unsettled in the poskim whether this does or does not constitute theft. This involves, again, very technical considerations of the laws of asmachta. Some people say that asmachta is only a concern when you have some control over the outcome. You think you'll be, so some argue that you can distinguish between betting on sports or you think that your keen understanding of the game or your insights will make you win and you overestimate yourself, but something which is pure chance, like a lottery or dice, fair dice. There's no issue of asmachta. All the posts can disagree. There's a tremendous debate, tremendous arguments in the early authorities, the later authorities. Do we rule that the gambling as asmachta is or is not theft? It is essentially an unresolved machlokas. To the extent that there is a resolution, there is a distinction between Sfardim and Ashkenazim, and this is a central theme that runs down to contemporary authorities. Sfardim tend to follow the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch, who follows the ruling of the Rambam, who follows the opinion that gambling is asmachta, and gambling therefore constitutes theft. Ashkenazim, to a large extent, follow the ruling of the Ramah, who follows the ruling of Rashi and the Tosafist in this case, who rule that gambling is not an asmachta and gambling is not theft. As we'll discuss a little bit later, there are therefore major distinguished Sephardic poskim of the contemporary period who take a very hard line on gambling and who argue that, the most famous being Rav Avadya Yosef, the leading Sephardic authority of the last century, who ruled flat out that a Jew, Sephardic Jew at least, may not participate in the Israeli National Lottery, the Mifal HaPayas. It is gambling, it is prohibited for Sfardim, it is out-and-out theft, and therefore he actually forbids it, full stop. While Ashkenazim, he himself concedes that for Ashkenazim, the rules are more lenient because they follow a halachic tradition which does not consider it out-and-out theft. Now, the other opinion in the Talmud is, even if it's not theft, you're still postulatus. The reason is because you are engaged in activity which is eina osek b'yishuva shel olam. You're engaged in frivolous and unproductive activity. But again, this is primarily a concern, halachically, to forbid it halachically, this is primarily a concern for someone who is a professional gambler, someone who has no productive occupation and devotes his days to playing poker or something, to making money off doing something which is with no productive purpose. Such a person, according to everyone, is doing something wrong. But according to the Rambam, the Sardim, it's the problem of theft. According to the Ramah, the professional gambler still is doing something wrong by devoting his life to a non-productive pastime, non-productive activity. But someone who occasionally gambles, according to the Ramah, the mainstream opinion seems to be that it would not be prohibited. It's instructive also to read the language of the Rambam. Understanding exactly what the Rambam holds is a very difficult topic. The Rambam is difficult and inconsistent a little bit in the different places he talks about the halacha, but broadly speaking, the Rambam brings both these concerns. The Rambam begins by describing gambling, people who play with eitzim, with wooden chips or tokens of some sort, troros, pebbles, bones. They make tnayim, they make arrangements that whoever wins will get money, whoever loses will pay money, or will give up his money. Rambam says that this is, if you take the money, derech tzchok v'hitzel, via these kinds of frivolous pastimes, that is gezel. He talks about horse racing or you know, fighting, whichever the animal wins is going to win. All this is gezel midivrayim, this is rabbinically prohibited theft. Then the Rambam goes on and he says that in certain other cases where there might not be a prohibition of theft, still, he says, you have a secondary prohibition of eina osik bidvar, eina osik, a person is being osik bidvarim b'telem, he's engaged in worthless and pointless pastime. And the Rambam has one of his classic inspiring formulations, ein roi la'adam shiyasa kol yamav, a person should not engage, it's inappropriate for a person to engage all his days, ela b'divrei chachma v'yishuva shel olam, a person should either be engaged in divrei chachma, wisdom, Torah, academia, whatever it is, and yeshua shel olam, productive activity, not in pointless, you know, unproductive things like gambling.
With professional
patriot
or
get to that too.
What?
Day trading. So that's one of the things I want to discuss a little bit about different types of financial activity of the yeshua shel olam. Yeah.
Is there no one who
thinks
that makes a distinction between a lottery type game and...
There are distinctions, we'll get to them too. So, actually, this is an apt place to discuss some of these to start discussing questions about financial speculation. So, investing is not one thing. Investing, as you alluded to by mentioning specifically day trading, investing, there are the people who finance ventures, there are venture capitalists, there are people who buy stock in the secondary markets, there are people who buy options and hedge, and there are people who engage in day trading, there are people who engage in high-frequency trading models where you just sell and make profits in microseconds and so on. So do any of these types of financial activities fall into either of these categories? Let's focus first on yeshuva shel olam. So this is obviously a loaded question. You want to know whether Wall Street is engaging in yeshuva shel olam. So if you ask Senator Warren, she would tell you that we need, you know, taxes worth hundreds of billions of dollars on certain types of financial activity because they are not owed to be Jewish Lolem, they cause the great meltdowns and so on. And it depends who you ask. Are the more conservative economists, traditional economists would tell you that having robust capital markets and the freedom to engage in different types of financial transactions are all relevant to healthy markets, which are good for society. I am not an economist, and even today there's a fair amount of hot debate over whether there are entire classes of financial speculation which are pointless at best and unhealthy and deleterious for the markets at worst. So a lot of this will depend on the factual question of whether you believe that you can carve out certain categories like day trading or the more exotic, newer varieties, which are purely destructive and serve no purpose. So to some extent, it's a factual question which I'm not competent to answer. I do want to quote, though, one very interesting discussion, and from an economic perspective, I'm not sure I understand this, but just to give at least one striking perspective on this from a Jewish perspective, this is from Rabbi Eliyahu Kalatkin. Rabbi Eliyahu Kalatkin was a great Polish Talmud Chacham. He was one of the leading poskim of about a century ago, World War I era. He was a very interesting fellow. He was grew up in traditional Polish-Russian society. Never really became a maskil. He was considered one of the leading, one of the most esteemed heads of the of the rabbinic establishment, but he did have a curious mind. He spent a few years apparently hanging around in St. Petersburg, teaching himself foreign languages in the Russian libraries, and he was well-read. So he has he's talking actually about a completely different topic. He's talking about the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvah of making Aliyah. So he comments that one of the main heterim, leniencies that postim have given, why we don't all get up and make Aliyah, one of the caveats that postim have said is that if a person is financially stable in the United States, and by going to Israel, he will have no visible means of support. He'll have to either throw himself on the chalukah system back then in Europe, or he'll have to, you know, beg, borrow, and steal, and he won't have a stable source of income. Poskim said, various Poskim have said, Mil Tzedakah, that the value, the rabbis, of course, tell us about Gadol Hanenami Ge'akapav, the value of supporting yourself honorably with dignity, is such a great value, and having to throw yourself on the community is bad, is inappropriate. Therefore, Poskim said, if a person will not have a viable source of income in Israel, and he has one in Chutz Laaretz, that is a reason to allow staying in Chutz Laaretz. Rabbi Leo Kolapkin said, this applies, he says, to someone who has an upright and decent and productive source of making a livelihood. This, he says, certainly to someone who actually works with his hands, he says, that he actually builds, he does something, that's fine, that's Yishuv Ha'olam, he says. Or, he says, even the managerial class, he says, people who are mefakeach or mefakeid, the zocher pol, and people who are managing productive enterprises, that's also a thing, he may not be building with his hands. He's also engaged in Yishuv Ha'olam, the whole system of productive enterprise, both the people who actually build, the people who manage the builders, that's fine. Those are all honorable, he says, and upright activities. He says, however, he says, someone who is not Osik B'Yishuv Ha'olam, the phrase we're dealing with here, Kagon, he says, someone who is involved in Esek HaShtaros, the business of Shtaros, documents, papers, he says, Ol Shar Ol V'Yared, he speculates and bets, and prices going up and down. It's like Misach HaBekuvi, he says, it's like gambling. It's a Chil Hashem, he says. You have the Jews, you know, the perception people have of Jews who are just manipulating markets and making a killing off the backs of... this is kind of a very populist, anti-Wall Street kind of, you know, the Jewish bankers who are just, you know, playing with papers and making money on the back of everyone else. He says, it's a terrible thing. It's a Chil Hashem. He says he understands. He says Jews do this because Aniyu Tamanavela, people are poor, they're desperate. Jews can't do a lot of things. He says people are forced to engage in desperate pursuits. He can't call that, he says, Yishuv Ha'olam. Doesn't say what he means, but Esek HaShtaros, the people who are engaged as some kind of financial speculators, he has a very dim view of activity. Such a person can't say that he's being Osik B'Yishuv Ha'olam, even if he's bringing home money to support his family. What he has in mind exactly by Esek HaShtaros, you know, certainly I think most, you know, mainstream economists would agree that functioning capital markets are fundamental for society to work. As a matter of fact, the Mishnah goes on, the Mishnah talks about mouth of a ribbis. The Mishnah Sanhedrin says someone who lends money at ribbis is engaged in terrible behavior. So for a Jew, obviously, lending money to ribbis from one Jew to another is a terrible avera, the issur of ribbis. Now, although sometimes you find in the poskim explanations of that, how ribbis is a terrible activity, the modern world runs on ribbis. How many of us could afford to ever buy a house if there would be no mortgage industry? I mean, it's nice if you have several hundred thousand dollars in savings that you can afford to spend, but without mortgages, you know, who's buying a house? You know, so good, we find all kinds of loopholes to get around ribbis, but the point is to get as close as you can as ribbis without actually crossing the line. But the point is, so certainly from a modern economic perspective, we believe that capital markets are essential for running an economy. We believe that having financing, having loans, and having credit is essential for modern industry. So again, can you carve out, you know, categories within financial trading to argue that, yes, normal investing, buying and holding equities and stuff like that is sensible and is productive and helps companies raise money on the capital markets and involves, the economists would tell you that the goal of a capital market is to funnel and to shape flows of capital into the enterprises in which they will be most effectively employed. So fine, that's a textbook definition. If that works and the kind of investing that promotes that, then great. You know, the high-frequency trading and the day trading, yes or no. You know, some will argue that it increases liquidity, that some will argue that once the government gets its hands on regulating it, you know, who knows where it will stop. You know, there are all kinds of arguments, well beyond my area of expertise, there are all kinds of arguments you can make for why allowing different types of financial activity is a good thing or a bad thing. So I'll call upon them, you know, that certainly there would be basis to say that a categories of financial activity, too, which have no purpose except to make money but have no... but would be generally agreed to have no broader benefit to society, might very well be problematic from the perspective of Einos Ikbi Shuvah Shalom. Absolutely. That, yeah, absolutely. So the mortgages in the secondary market, mortgage-backed securities and so on, so all these things, those who invented them, those who defended them will argue that by enabling banks to sell off mortgages, that it enables more mortgages to be made, and it directs more capital toward where it's useful. Yeah, so again, I'm not an economist. I haven't read seriously on the topic. And as I said, the one point I will make is that to a very large extent there, you would think the halakha really has to depend on the economic reality. So halakha would have to consult economists, would have to get a good economic picture, and there may not even be a good economic picture because, as we said, Senator Warren will have a very different opinion on this as to the heads of Goldman Sachs. So that obviously that you can get conservative economists publishing papers in one direction, and you can get liberal economists and politicians publishing papers in the other direction. And so certainly I'm not confident, and it'd be too far afield to actually, that's a valid question. I agree. I'm just saying the halakha, I think, should to a large extent depend here on the economic underlying economic reality. Get to that in a minute. You think?
Suppose a person is doing a day trading, and they're thinking it's worth their family, and they thought they're going to give 10% to the shul or to other charitable organizations. But if the money is used for
it's an interesting question. The question is, if you're dealing with something that's absolutely prohibited, then of course the means don't justify the end. You can't steal and give money to tzedakah. The question, though, is that let's say we're dealing with something which is not inherently prohibited. It's not gadol like the Ramah. It's just a question of osik b'shuvah shel olam. Does the fact that I'm going to make money by engaging in activity which is not productive, but I'm going to use that money well, I'm going to support my family, I'll support shuls, I'll support yeshivas, I'll support poor people, I'll do all kinds of good things with the money, so it's not like the means are absolutely utter to begin with, and I'm going to have good use of the money. Interesting question, I'm not sure. My impression is the poskim still don't like the idea of making money by using Einos Ikbi Shuvah Shel Olam means, but it is an interesting question. That's a tough question. In the laws of Atmachta, Chazal often made assumptions about whether a normal person is gomer das or not. Today we have, first of all, we have subcategories. We have professional investors. We have people who are experienced, people who are naive. When you fill out an account for a brokerage, they'll ask you sometimes, what is your level of experience? 1 year, 2 years, you consider yourself expert investor, advanced, intermediate, novice. So there are different classes. Then there are individual people. Some people are very naive. Some people are, read up on it and know a great deal. Some people are financially savvy. Some people are good with numbers. Interesting question. I haven't seen much in the literature on that, so I don't want to get too much into that. I want to turn now for a moment to someone raised the question of whether in financial trading there's any issue of asmachta. So here we have another very interesting question. Asmachta, as I mentioned, is a general contractual issue that, very broad-ranging principle that has applications throughout Choshen Mishpat, throughout Jewish law. The one major exception to asmachta laid down by the halakhic tradition is that, according to many authorities, perhaps most authorities, any type of transaction which is industry standard, which is widespread, commonly executed, commonly honored, commonly followed, will not have any problem with asmachta. If certain types of transactions are not just you creatively put it into a contract, if it's the kind of standard thing which is widely done, and the Chassam Sofer says widely followed, Chassam Sofer says a little cynically that certain types of clauses are routinely put into contracts, and then they're routinely litigated afterwards. That people don't agree with them, and they end up in court all the time. Those maybe not, but certain types of contracts, clauses which are routinely followed, nobody has any question, everyone knows this is how things are done. The poskim establish, many poskim establish a doctrine that does not suffer the defect of asmachta. If so, that would almost certainly eliminate any question of asmachta from pretty much any of these types of financial transactions. Anything which is traded on a standard and regulated market, I'm not selling stock across my dining room table. I'm selling it on exchanges which are, obviously regulated. There are standard rules. Millions of people follow them. It happens every day. So that would probably eliminate asmachta through and through. There are probably a few other reasons why there's no asmachta there either. partly because when you deal with non-Jews, the rules are you typically follow the rating contract law and not the law of a market. So there are probably several reasons why in the standard public capital markets, there'd be no reason to have a smachta. Again, in private arrangements where you're buying out companies and you arrange a one-off contract to have a buyout of a company, which is a customized one-of-a-kind contract, and especially if you have unusual clauses, you might end up with a smachta. But certainly, you know, normal securities trading that an individual does on a public market would probably not suffer from a smachta according to most or all opinions. Yeah, so that's kind of the point I want to get to next, which is, again, continuing along with the question of analyzing this nexus between the contrast between normal commercial financial business activity versus gambling. In all cases, you put your money down, you pay your money, you take your chances, and how does halakha distinguish, you know, the winning and the losing of business and that of gambling? So we've already seen that, you know, Leo Kolaskin kind of is skeptical toward purely speculative financial trading, but the truth is there are a number of other poskim who also establish various leniencies with regard to different types of lotteries and raffles and games of chance, largely on the basis of this argument that business is mutter, despite the fact that people engage in risky business also. People engage in funding startups and other types of new businesses, go out of business all the time. People lose a lot of money, and that's mutter. So Poskim do grapple with this and do try to explain what the difference is, and the result of that analysis commonly is that many Poskim have found various leniencies with regard to certain types of gambling themselves. So, for example, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, or Chaim Jaster quotes Rav Aaron Lichtenstein as arguing that a lottery or a raffle in general is going to be mutter, he says. And the way he explains it is, someone who purchases a ticket is essentially buying a right to compete. It's no different from buying a stake in a business whose outcome is iffy, who nobody knows what's going to happen. At the time of the purchase, the buyer consents to the sale, changes his mind, it's too late. Undoing such a sale would be the equivalent of one who purchases a stock demanding to abrogate the sale after a subsequent stock market crash. So Lichtenstein is explicitly arguing that buying a raffle ticket, buying a lottery ticket, is not really different from buying a stake in a business that has a good chance of failing. So again, the question is, how is it different from every other type of gambling? Why does he see betting on a horse race or betting on a hand of poker as being so different from buying a raffle ticket? So that part is still not entirely clear. There, one related argument that many posts can make is that some posts can argue that we can distinguish between betting against the house, so to speak, and betting against an individual. So some posts can argue, this argument was made, for example, by Rav Avadya Hadaya in the Sefer Yaskel Avdi. He was talking about raffles, communal organizations or governments or people who raffle off items of value. So they sell, let's say they have an item worth $1,000, they sell 100 tickets at $15 a ticket, or whatever the numbers might be, they make money. So he argues, the person who's paying out the prize, he's laughing all the way to the bank. He's not losing anything. He made a very careful decision about how much his prize is worth and how many tickets he's going to sell. He's very happy. When a Vegas casino makes a slot machine, so they carefully design those machines to pay out a certain percentage of the money that comes in. They want to pay out money. They don't want every play, every throw to be lose. Nobody's going to those machines anymore. So they very carefully sit down with mathematicians and psychologists, wherever these people are. They calculate exactly how much money they need to pay out in order to maximize the amount of people who keep coming back and how big the payout should be versus how frequent they should be. They're very happy to pay out 85%, 90%, 95%, depending on the game. They're very happy to do that because they know that in the long run that the goal is that they get their edge, whatever it is. They're certainly not being stolen from. This is all exactly part of their business model. So they're not losing anything. The question is, are they stealing your money when you pay for the tickets? So again, Rav Avadya Hadaya, with regard to the lotteries and others, he says, when you win and you take the prize, you're certainly not committing any kind of theft from the proprietor because he has a very successful business going. As to him taking money from you, so again, he seems to feel like Rav Lichtenstein, when you pay your money for a lottery ticket, you're simply buying something that has calculable value. You're simply buying a chance to win. He seems to feel that that's not gambling either. Now, the question would be, another thing that I found interesting, which I didn't find too much discussion of, the early poskim have said that the professional gamblers, the Talmud says, professional gamblers are ena osik b'shuvah shel olam. So again, if I'm a tourist who goes to Vegas, I control my gambling habits, I spend a couple hundred dollars on a trip to Vegas, I'm certainly, just a few hours out of the year, I'm certainly not violating the rule of Eina Osik B'Shuva Shel Olam. The question is, are they who do this full time, they have an industry which is thousands and thousands of people who are just involved in gambling, do they have a problem of Eina Osik B'Shuva Shel Olam? It could be argued not. It could be argued that they are providing entertainment. They're providing a service which, in theory, potentially, can be used responsibly. I'd like to know the percentage of their winnings that come from people who are gambling responsibly versus those that come from those who are not. But in theory, they're providing an entertainment service, which is not much different in a certain sense from a Broadway show or from a professional athlete who plays baseball and makes millions of dollars entertaining the public. One could argue that providing a service called entertainment. But again, the question is, the Poskim clearly saw gambling as being bad and more frivolous and less than just a neutral form of entertainment. And the truth is, if we go back and look at what some of the Poskim have written over the centuries, the discussion of gambling for money often shades off into a discussion of engaging in games and fun in general. So Reb Chaim ben Venisti, the Knesset Gdola in Turkey, 17th century, he talks about chess playing. He quotes earlier sources, which are actually a little bit ambiguous. Those who were skeptical about playing the skaki, which is commonly translated as chess, he actually quotes early Poskim who banned it. And he says, well, maybe they were talking about playing it for money. People were wagering on these games, but just playing it, he says, just playing it for fun, for entertainment, he says, the minhag is to be mekel. He says the custom was to be lenient, and then deliciously he quotes a few examples. He says that Rabbi Bassan, the great rabbinic leader of the time, he heard that he himself used to play. And then he says, the Knesset Gdola says, his Rebbe, his teacher, the Marit, Rabbi Yosef Avtrani, he says, he apparently didn't play, at least not in public, he says, but he apparently was a kibitzer. He says, when he saw two people playing chess, Hayimalami Lehem Derech Hatzchok, he would teach them how to play. He would say, oh, you move there, you should do this, I have a better strategy for you. So he apparently knew the game. Whether he actually played or not, it's hard to know. So the Marit, basically, the Knesset Gdola says, we know it was the custom to tolerate and even participate in these types of games. His conclusion is that these were people playing without money involved. So, again, as a Sfardi, he tends to be stricter about the idea of wagering, a problem of asmakta, a problem of gezel. But as a form of entertainment, as a pastime, a harmless pastime, he says the custom was widespread, both games of skill, like chess, as well as different types of games of chance. Some games are hybrids, like backgammon, some games are totally chance. But whatever it is, the custom was, he says, people would play, although, again, he argues that the custom, he says, in his time, in Turkey, in the 17th century, the custom was to play for entertainment, which is still probably the way most people play chess today, except, I guess, the professionals who are playing for prize money. But in general, most chess players probably just play for entertainment, and that, he says, is fine. Again, if someone did that full-time, you know, just for fun, I don't know what he would say. Is that Yeshua Shel Olam or not? We can wonder about that, but certainly someone who plays casually for chess without money is certainly okay, according to him. Although, again, so returning to lotteries for a moment. So some of the Sfaradic Poskim in Israel, as I said before, were quite strict, most notably Rav Avadi Yosef. He takes a very hard line. He's the most widely quoted. He argues that for Sfaradim, gambling is theft. He doesn't go with all these Sfaras that it's like business, it's like financial speculation, he doesn't have any of these Sfaras. He just says that it is absolutely usher. Sfaradim may not participate in the lottery. And Moshe Sternbach says that also this is not just him, he says other Sfaradim too. Several Sfaradic Poskim have taken a very hard-line position that even buying a lottery ticket is absolutely prohibited, at least for Sfaradim. As you mentioned earlier, Rav Avadia Hadaya, another leading Sfaradic Poskim a little bit earlier, was not of that opinion. He felt that lottery tickets were okay. And Rav Moshe Sternbach, who was certainly not a Sfaradi, was an Ashkenazi, he argues that buying lottery tickets in general is not such a problem, even for Sfaradim. He has a number of reasons. Also, similar to Aaron Lichtenstein, he argues that this is really a form of business, he says. Nichnas bazela hashka'ak mabachalasek. It's really simply a form of investment. It's, you know, the odds of winning are a longer shot maybe than most investments, but he says that he distinguishes, as some posts can do, between whether you pay the money up front, buy the ticket, and then collect on it later, or you actually build afterward, which is worse. He actually argues, based on that distinction, he actually suggests that maybe if you buy stocks on margin, or if you buy stocks where you don't pay the money up front, maybe that's worse. Again, it's hard to understand It's really business. Business is surely allowable, even if you make investments by taking out loans. He himself seems to conclude that that's still mutter, that once we make the basic argument this is a form of a business deal, doesn't matter if you pay the cash out of your pocket up front or not. He argues at some length that buying lottery tickets is mutter. One very interesting argument he makes is that he distinguishes, I started to mention earlier, between playing against primarily the house and playing against individuals. He brings a famous comment of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik is purportedly used to remark, he says, someone comes to a Rav with a shaila and kashrus. He slaughtered a cow. He has a problem with treifus. The rabbi says the cow is treif. He has to write off 1,000 rubles, a big hit. Fine. He's a Jew. He respects the halacha. He accepts that. The rabbi knows. The rabbi's expert in Torah law. Throws away the cow. So someone comes to a din Torah for 50 rubles. The rabbi says, he wins, you lose. The guy's upset. The guy says, the rabbi doesn't know. I think it's not fair. I know better. He says, what's the difference? So there are different answers given. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik purportedly used to say, the problem is not the losing. The problem is that the other guy won. So that human nature, it's not just about losing the money. It's that you feel you lost to someone. You feel someone beat you. That's intolerable. So Reb Sternbach argues, you're playing poker. You're playing a game where someone else is collecting money from you. That, he says, you can't give up. It's not machta. You don't really mean to give it away. You can't really bear to part with it. You give it because that's the rules of the game. But that's not machta. You don't do it b'leiv shalem. That's the problem. He says, lotteries, or when you play at a casino, there might be six other people at your table, but you don't know them from Adam. He says, you're not taking money from anyone else personally. There's nothing personal involved here. It's just a question of numbers and of speculation, he says. That is less a problem of Asmachta than these types of cases. Well, so some lotteries are in between. They have the Powerballs or whatever, where sometimes nobody wins, and they have more lotteries, and eventually someone wins. If you keep going long enough, someone wins, right? Yeah, so it's an interesting question. Is there a distinction between a lottery that has a guaranteed winner and a lottery that doesn't? An interesting distinction. I'm not sure the Post can make that distinction, but maybe worth some further consideration. One further sparrer of Sternbach says, and this one Rabbi Jaster talks about also in his discussion, is that many lotteries are conducted by worthy charitable institutions. There is a rule that insofar as you're concerned about asmachta, that asmachta does not apply with regard to tzedakah, with regard to charitable organizations, because you don't really mind. You know, even though you like to win, you know the money's going for a good cause. You're not just throwing it away or giving it to your obnoxious neighbor. You know it's going to, usually when you buy a lottery for a charity, it's a charity you like anyway. You don't really mind if they get the money. So that's another as far as some folks can argue why there are no issues of asmachta when it comes to lotteries run by charitable organizations. Now, I'm sorry? Right, that's a good point, right. So as we said, there are always two issues in the lotteries, there's the winning and the losing. They're considering, obviously, the problem with the charity taking money from you improperly. As to winning, there I think you have the other spar, that when the charity pays out the winning, they sat down, they know they're selling more tickets, so it's guaranteed, there's no risk, they know exactly what they're doing. They're paying out 1,000 and they're getting, hopefully, 3,000, so I think they're relying probably on that kind of argument. Now, at the end of the day, as the Rejecta summarizes, Poskim historically have not liked gambling. Many of them have acknowledged that gambling might not technically be usher. Poskim have often been against it. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the literature is not in the standard halachic sources. It's in communal edicts. We find people have written scholarly articles going throughout the ages, communities that have banned gambling. One of the most interesting and colorful discussions of gambling occurs in the 17th century. Italian communities were repeatedly banning gambling because of the bad effects on society. So, Rabbi Yehuda Aryeh of Modena, Leon Modena, surely the most colorful rabbi in Jewish history, he himself had issues with gambling. He writes in his autobiography that he repeatedly succumbed to the temptation to gamble. I lost 100 dukats on this day, and I lost 50 on that day, and the Satan seduced me again, and I wasted more money. He actually wrote the tract against gambling, Dur Meirah. He was actually wrote a famous tshuva, however, in his halachic tshuvas, where there was once a great controversy in his time where the leadership of one of the Italian communities issued an edict banning gambling, and there was a lot of pushback. Some people felt they had no right to do that. They were overstepping their halachic authority. He wrote a celebrated major tshuva arguing that the community had no right to ban gambling. First of all, he argued gambling was a halachically permissible practice, and because of that, he argued the community was overstepping their bounds by banning what was a perfectly legitimate you know, has bad consequences sometimes, but he argued at length that they had no right to do that. However, on the whole, there is a very long history of communities banning and condemning gambling in all its varieties. Rabbi Jachter brings Mordechai Willig, instructing NCSY to refrain from all forms of gambling. Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Lichtenstein told Rabbi Jachter, he reports that casinos and gambling halls are symbols of decadence in society. Again, you know, they call Vegas, you know, Sin City. Vegas is in America the semel of sin. Rav Soloveitchik said about gambling, bad habits, don't do it. Rav Soloveitchik obviously meant to say, can't tell you what to us earlier, you know, there certainly are grounds to be lenient for Ashkenazim in particular. Certainly you can't say it's strictly forbidden, but it's a bad habit, don't do it. Now again, just as we discussed with alcohol, with tobacco is widely recognized, you know, that it's very difficult for people to use tobacco in a responsible way. Almost anything is dangerous. Very few people can smoke and limit it to a small and healthy amount of smoking. There is no safe level. You know, with alcohol, people still fail differently. Most people fail. Alcohol can be enjoyed responsibly, as per the taglines of some of those beer commercials. We feel that way. Most of us feel like that. We can drink a little on Shabbos. We can drink at a simcha. Obviously, alcoholism is a problem. People are starting to realize more and more how widespread a problem it is. But still, you know, we don't ban alcohol. So the question is, should gambling be treated something like alcohol, that it should be carefully kept track of, it should be warned against but not strictly prohibited, or should we take a much harder line and say, again, the facts are, the history shows us, in theory maybe it's okay, but practically it leads to terrible problems and we should ban it outright. So there I think you'll find, let's we'll finish up for another minute, and we'll take questions in a moment. There I think you'll find different attitudes among poskim as to whether we should come down in all our you know, indignation and condemnation against gambling, or we should say, it's mutter, just don't get too carried away. With regard to Hanukkah specifically, there is a several hundred year tradition of Jews gambling on Hanukkah, cards in many of the initial, karten, klafen in many of the initial formulations, later the dreidel. So some poskim indeed came down very harshly against gambling on Hanukkah, such illustrious poskim as the Chavak Chaim in the Mishnah Berurah, as well as Aruch HaShulchan, have very, very harsh language condemning gambling for money on Hanukkah. Aruch HaShulchan's language is Onshan Rav, their punishment will be great. It's a negat taras that has spread among Jews, he says. Terrible, terrible thing. Many averis are hinge on this. Bir Halacha too, in his commentary on Hanukkah, says terrible averis, so the poskim have all condemned it. Yet, not everyone. There are poskim who have said that it's, there are poskim who have justified it, you've rationalized it. The Sefer Pesukei Teshuvos brings from the Klausenberger Rebbe that the kind of Hasidish justification that das macht is, I'm stealing from you, you know, we're hostile toward each other, we're not happy, we don't get along on Hanukkah because everyone's on a high spiritual level, we're all like one big family, we don't begrudge each other our winnings, we're all together, you know, persuasive or not, but the fact is, Rosh Chaim Donnerfeld also apparently justified some limited amount of gambling as being, it's customary, it's an outlet, people need to blow off a little steam, he says, as long as it's done responsibly, it can be done in respectable ways. So, you know, in general, I think it's fair to say it's yotze schara b'hafsedo, the danger and the downside is probably greater than the benefit. On the other hand, the consensus probably for Ashkenazim is that Sfaradim is a different case, but for Ashkenazim it is probably not strictly usher, although again, because of all the problems and the fraught nature of it, probably something that one should stay away from. Yes, so there are actually a number of poskim who prohibit specific types of activities that involve other problems. So, for example, Rav Adi Yosef has a tshuva where he sharply prohibits Jews from attending, I think, bullfighting or cockfighting, these types, absolutely tzar balechayim, and destructive. There are several other prohibitions the poskim occasionally drag in, right? There's tzar balechayim. Some poskim talk about chukas hagayim, if there are certain types of, like, you know, they talk about, like, the Romans used to have, Chazal, so how the Romans had their gladiator fights and their things, and Chazal tell us we shouldn't follow in the ways of the gayim, particularly if they're bad. So again, chukas hagayim, by most poskim, is understood to mean things which have an objectively immoral or improper use, priestess, or, you know, other things. So certainly anything that has a tinge of immoral or cruel behavior could certainly be prohibited both independently as well as because of Hukos HaGoyim, and some poskim do. The question again, right, so things like right, cockfighting, and those things are specifically mentioned. So things like boxing, I don't remember seeing anyone specifically discuss something like boxing, which is a contact sport to the point where the goal is, unlike, you know, hockey or basketball, where it's part of the game, it's not the game, at least, you know. But you know, boxing, yes. I don't remember if I saw specifically anything about boxing, but yeah, potentially though those could be other concerns, yeah.
The halakhic authorities that say that certain forms of handling the
So the Talmud and the Poskim use language of Gezel Midivrayim, Rabbinic Gezel. The Talmud is full of cases where the rabbis extended biblical categories to cover other cases to put them in. So you learn ribbis, for example, so there's a myriad of financial transactions that are prohibited halakha l'maaseh because of ribbis. Many or most of them are not biblical ribbis, they're extensions of ribbis established by the rabbis. So there is a significant concept called Gezel Midivrayim, which are cases where it would not be biblical theft but would be rabbinic. And that being said, some of these things might actually fall into the category of biblical theft, but in general, I think gambling, insofar as it's theft, would be considered, the Rambam's language, Gezel Midivrayim. The rabbis have the power to prohibit that as a Takana Chazal, as in the same way we like Hanukkah Neris, that's a rabbinic institution, so this is a kind of rabbinic extension. It's a different category of rabbinic ordinance, but basically it would be a rabbinic extension of the prohibitions of theft to include cases which are not out-and-out theft, but which are considered, you know, somehow taking money from someone improperly, even if it's not, you know, strict highway robbery. Yeah, so as I said, once you depart from the halakhic literature and you move to kind of the social histories of the Jewish communities, there is a lot of talk about whether the rabbis who prohibited it, they focus on social destruction. So whether they explicitly make the class argument that it affects the poor more than the rich, or that, but clearly they saw it was affecting people who couldn't afford it. We're not talking about the Saudi princes who can blow a few million and then go back and have plenty and then not even miss it. Obviously, that's not destructive. That might be, I know it's be Jewish olam, but that's not destructive. Clearly, the Jewish communities that were concerned about the damage to the fabric of society were worried about people who could not afford it, people who were you know, gambling their kids, you know, their kids' bread, or their starting fights with their wives, the people who could not afford it that were. Whether they explicitly make the kind of class argument that it's affecting the poor more than the rich, I'm not sure. You have to read more about the text of these ordinances, which again are kind of like.
Just in terms of habit, something that, you know, like participation
rate. So I would actually be very curious to that. I'm sure they don't. I would just wonder, as a layman, you know, the casinos obviously make a lot of their money from rich people who gamble large, high rollers. On the other hand, the old lady on the slot machine who's feeding in, you know, her pension might be doing it more steadily. So I don't know what percentage of their profits are coming from people who are throwing away their pensions, what percent are coming from the Saudi princes and the high rollers. So I don't know, you know, which are which. You have the numbers. I guess you can show them to me. We'll take a look. But yeah.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Just wanted to mention a couple upcoming community events.